So we just had that ruling come down from the Court of Appeals, unanimous ruling in the state's favor on that. And I know you were instrumental in bringing this bill about and are happy with the results of that lawsuit. Can you tell me why the bill came about and where you see it going forward?
Well, the bill related back to, you know, decades worth of disputes over water, how it gets priced, how it gets managed. And for me, it actually started back when I was doing environmental advocacy, and the preferred alternative in terms of how we managed our water and sewer was to create some sort of regional authority. Now, this would have been back in the 1990s. I arrived in the General Assembly in 2011 and teamed up with my then colleague, Representative Moffitt, and really pushed for a regional solution to water. And that was reflected in a bill. That bill was challenged by the city of Asheville. At the trial court level, the city prevailed. But on appeal, the Court of Appeals reversed that decision, finding that the statute was fully constitutional.
Why was it not acceptable for the city of Asheville to be running that water system?
Because the city of Asheville, to put it bluntly, has used its power over water as a weapon against its neighbors. And I come from Henderson County. We have a long history on water. We joined a water authority at one point in time that we thought was going to manage the water resources. The city of Asheville withdrew from that water authority, but some portion of the city of Asheville's water is coming from Henderson County and serves Henderson County residents. And so I view water as a regional resource and better managed by a regional entity that includes the city of Asheville, but not solely controlled by the city.
By the time I arrived in Asheville, it was long after the bill had passed and before all the problems. When you say Asheville used its water authority as a weapon, what do you mean by that?
I mean that in the past, in terms, it's tried to put in place differential rates. In the past, it has actually taken money out of the water that was generated from producing water and put it in its general fund to fund the city. Now, that hasn't been the practice recently. More recently, probably responding to the possibility that there would be a regional water authority. The city hasn't done that. But there's certainly a lot of history here. I mean, decades. The first lawsuit occurred in the 1930s. And so the history is rather replete with how the city of Asheville has used its water system.
So I'm just going to list off some of the criticisms that I've read about to this bill. One is that the city of Asheville is not compensated in any way and is losing the authority and may have invested some money into this authority.
I think that's a good example of the city of Asheville views this as their water system. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's paid for by the water users. They're not all city of Asheville residents. Some portion of what they call the City of Asheville water system was actually Buncombe County water system. Some portion of the water system is down in Henderson County. So, again, the city has acted as if this is all of their water. I think if anybody ever was able to in accounting, you'd find that the City of Asheville has taken over decades more money out of the system than they've put in. Although, to be fair, recent history is the opposite. Again, I think responding to the real possibility that someone would decide to set up a different type of local government, an authority, to manage this resource.
So the other criticism that I saw was that the city of Asheville is not adequately represented on this new board with 3 seats of the 15, although the majority of the water will be serving Asheville. What do you say to that?
I understand the concern. I understand that they would like more representation. They probably could have gotten more representation if their position had not been just outright opposing anything and everything related to the establishment of the authority. I should note that, we had the same set of issues around sewer, and regional sewer authority was set up, and it has been wildly successful. The French Broad River is so much cleaner because the authority was just about providing sewer service. They put all their money that they got out into the system, and that's really what has to happen here.
Uh-huh. When you say that they could have gotten more, possibly had they been more cooperative in deliberations, it seems like almost punitive in nature then that they didn't get that. Should they have had to go along with this legislation that they clearly opposed to basically get adequate representation on this board?
No, I don't think their representation is not adequate. They're the biggest player on this board, but the Water Authority is going to continue to grow and take in portions of Henderson, portions of unincorporated Buncombe, and all of these sort of cities around that already get water from the system operated by the city of Asheville. So I don't think it's unfair. I do think that the city at various points had other options. It was a decade ago that Buncombe County tried to purchase this system and, again, create a regional entity. For whatever set of reasons, the city fathers at that point decided not to go down that track, and we find ourselves where we are.
Okay. Shifting gears to the legislature. Now, you were very instrumental in the budget talks as the budget went on, continuing resolutions. A lot of this negotiating happened behind closed doors, and it's great to be able to talk to you because you were, like I mentioned, very instrumental in these talks. Could you kind of peel the curtain back any and give us a sense of what this whole process was like?
Well, the process starts with the governor puts forward his proposal. He did that. The House put forward its budget. The Senate responded. We were within a normal set of time parameters at that point. The problem was that the Senate's budget included all of their policy provisions of whatever type. It involved a certificate of need. It had the Medicaid proposal, reform proposal. It had all the tax stuff in it, just a myriad of policy things. And the House was just adverse to taking up all the policy in the budget. And so we stood firm on that issue, and we weren't going to do that. The other thing is there's some real differences of view as to how we ought to spend our money. The House spent a lot more money on education, wanted to fully fund teachers' assistants and driver's ed. The Senate was not willing to go down that road. And so the House, frankly, we sat back for 2 months because when two parties are not willing to talk about the issues that are most important to them, where do you go? In August, that changed. The governor pulled us together, but there was also the Senate shifted. The Senate was willing to spin out a lot of the policy stuff with agreements that we would take up some portion of it, mm-hmm. which we did. We ended up with a spending target, and they indicated a willingness to allow full funding of teachers' assistants and funding of drivers' education. And that's really what freed everything up. Once we got the spending target in late August, mm-hmm. it was not that long that we then had a budget.
That's interesting. So you're saying that the House essentially sort of waited out the clock, basically, sort of on the teacher's assistant issue, as far as waiting for the Senate to come around.
That's right. Yeah. We felt like we had public opinion with us, particularly on the education spending issues, and we were, you know, if their position was that they were not going to fund teacher's assistants and not going to fund driver's ed, then we were not yet prepared to come to the table to talk about a range of issues that they had. Now, they got, they were very much about tax reform. We agreed to take up tax reform. It actually is in the budget. It was part of the budget. They also, a high priority for them was Medicaid reform. We agreed to take that up, but outside the budget.
Mm-hmm.
There were various provisions in the budget to sort of tied all that, plus the bond package, all moved about the same time.
Mm-hmm. So during those 2 months, were the House and Senate not talking?
They weren't talking at my level. Once the Senate and the House do, you know, pass their respective budget, you have conferees appointed. Both the House and the Senate basically appointed anybody that had supported the budget as conferees. But as a practical matter, you're looking at the appropriations chairs on the House and Senate side. There's 3 senators and 4 House members. I'm one of the 4 House members, plus some of the leadership, the Speaker and the majority leaders. And so you've got a relatively small group of people that ultimately spend a lot of time locked behind closed doors trying to negotiate out the terms of the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And that occurred mostly in August and September and not back in late June and July as some group of people would have expected.
That's interesting. So 3 continuing resolutions were passed while the Senate and House weren't talking for those several months, basically.
The most serious discussions occurred after the second continuing resolution.
Do you think that the House and Senate should have been talking during that time?
You can't, in the ideal world, certainly, but how do you negotiate when you've got just a fundamental difference and one party doesn't want to talk about that issue? And that's where we were at that point in time.
Yeah, the reason I ask is just because it seems like I would have thought that the public perception of what was happening was that there were negotiations taking place and that there were major differences, but that they were taking time to be worked out. But it sounds like for 2 months, the two sides weren't talking at all.
All I can say is in June and July, there were not discussions going on between the House and the Senate at least its highest levels. Again, we've got lower appropriations committees. So, you know, we've got an education appropriations committee in both. And so I'm sure some discussion was had between senators and House members in some of the details. I know the transportation folks had sort of worked out a lot of their differences. But until we dealt with these big issues, nothing was going to move. And the education community, for example, teachers, were strongly supportive of the House side budget.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were not critical of the House budget.
Mm-hmm.
And during those months, my sense is that senators heard a lot from teachers and principals around the state, and House members were told by those same people, you know, hold the line. And if it takes time, take the time. We'd prefer you to reach a good agreement as opposed to rush to an agreement, and that's what we did.
Was there grumbling at the time over how leadership was handling those situations?
Everybody was tired of being in. This is supposedly a part-time job, and once you hit months 6 and 7 and 8, you begin to wonder how much of a part-time job. No, there wasn't grumbling within the House caucus about it. The Democrats, complained that we should have been able to get a budget when, you know, everything's controlled by Republicans. That was sort of the public message. Mm-hmm. But the private message oftentimes from some of these same people were, we're glad you're holding the line.
Yeah, yeah. Well, definitely the schools wanted the funding, of course, for teacher assistance. I'm sure that they started the year, as this happens a lot, as you know, uncertain with what was going to happen. I'm sure that there was a lot of anger directed towards the Senate then if these talks weren't taking place.
Well, that's true. Again, we had a 2% across-the-board pay raise in our budget. We would have preferred to have that. Ultimately, we got a $750 bonus for all employees. That's more than they would have gotten if you're on the low end, you know, if you're a janitor at a school. That's actually more money than the 2% would give you. Mm. But if you were on the high end, as a state employee or as a long-time teacher, $750 is less than what you would have gotten as a 2% across the board pay raise. Mm-hmm. But again, I heard from, unlike 2 years previous, where I was hearing a lot from teachers and principals, critical of both the House and the Senate, most of the constituent communications I got during the summer was, you know, Chuck, hold the line. Mm-hmm. If you need to stay there, as long as you need to stay there, stay. Do not back off. And again, I think we got to a good place. It's a compromise. Mm-hmm. It's not everything I would have liked, but it's because we were willing to stay, I think we got a better budget than we otherwise would have if we had tried to negotiate something out back in June.
Do you think there will be room for pay raises, better pay raises, that more along the lines of what the House wanted in the upcoming short session?
I hope so, but again, it takes two or three to tango here. Mm-hmm. And we have a budget. It's a two-year budget, so we don't have to pass a budget next year. The short session, though, is about coming back and completing work on legislation that has, you know, not made it all the way through the process, and to make adjustments in the budget. We'll see where we are in terms of our revenues. And I think the House's position is that we still believe we need to have an across-the-board pay raise. There hasn't been one other than a 1% in 1 year in the last 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. And we really need to adjust the whole compensation system to reflect that we're no longer in the recession and people need to be paid. Otherwise, they're going to go take other jobs.
That's also going to be pretty close to an election, which I'm sure won't be lost on a lot of the members in the legislature.
The elections are constant, and we are coming back early next year in April rather than May because the presidential primary and primaries have been moved up. So mm-hmm. I'm hoping that'll give us a little more time to get to the end of the fiscal year. And mm-hmm. if we're going to make some changes, maybe we can do it in a more timely fashion.
How did you think as far as the budget tax provisions went, as far as allowing the corporate tax rate to drop a little further, lowering income tax rates, but also expanding sales taxes to more services. Were you pleased with those proposals?
Broadly, yes. My concern is on the appropriation side is that we don't make too many tax cuts that make it hard to fund salary pieces and other things in the budget that need to be funded. I mean, I think we're underfunding education, for example. Now, do I think we've sort of got ourselves turned in the right direction? Yeah. I mean, there's roughly a 5% increase in total funding of K-12 education. Is that enough? No, but we began to put money back. But that all depends on how much money you have, and that's a reflection of the tax policy. Mm-hmm. Lowering the personal income tax rate was a good thing. Moving up the total personal exemption is a good thing. I was very glad to have the unlimited medical and charitable deductions in the tax proposal too.
Mm-hmm. And what about the portion of that would distribute sales taxes more to rural counties? Were you happy with that? And I know that was somewhat of a compromise.
It was very much of a compromise. That piece of the tax reform package was not very high on my priority list. Mm-hmm. I probably wouldn't have supported it if any county or city were going to end up having to take a cut. And we were able to get to a position where no municipality, no county is taking a cut. But clearly there were winners and losers here. To some degree, I want to make sure we don't end up with a two North Carolina situation. And so distributing the sales tax in a way that gets more money to some of the poorer places in the state, I think generally is a good thing. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the economic drivers of the state are in places like Asheville and Raleigh and Charlotte, and we can't set up a policy that doesn't give our cities enough money to run on.
Uh-huh. So you would
a balance.
So you were opposed to Harry Brown's proposal when it originated, I assume.
As his original proposal, I would not have supported.
Okay.
I was more comfortable, although again, this would not have been, my highest priority, mm-hmm. but it was a high priority for the Senate, and we had to move on this in some fashion, mm-hmm. if we were going to get a bond package through, if we're going to get a budget through. They all were sort of tied together.
Mm-hmm. And what about the bond package? Were you happy with what came out of the negotiations for that?
Yeah, I was. I would have been perfectly happy with some of the bond being used for road projects. The bond could have been upwards to $3 billion, but we ultimately settled on two. We don't have transportation projects in there. It's mostly largely education, got a nice piece for the state park system. Mm-hmm. So with interest rates being as low as they are, with the bond rating that the county, the state has, we ought to be funding capital projects like people fund their house. We shouldn't have to spend all our money in 1 year. Let's spread out the expense. And the bond does that. Mm-hmm. I'll be working in the spring to hopefully garner support in Henderson County for passage of the bond.
And JDIG grants were expanded as well.
That was a major interest of the governor.
Mm-hmm. And the House went along very early with that.
We did. And it was one of those things that got hung up and ultimately got, funded in a way that everybody was relatively comfortable with.
I'm not sure if you can answer this, but do you have any sense of why the House was so much more willing to spend money in this session as the Senate sort of kind of tightened the purse strings a lot more?
Well, I don't know that I understand it completely. People are always asking me, how could, you got a Republican governor, Republican Senate, Republican House, they seem so different. But the House is sort of bottom up and the Senate is more top down. The House is, a lot of us, made some really hard cuts back in 2011, 2012, 2013, reflective of the fact that we just didn't have the money, and we had to cut things, and we kept telling people at that point in time that, when good times came, we would hopefully be in a position to put money back. And I think that is the predominant view of House members. I think the Senate view is more reflective of the fact that they really don't like to see government grow, and lots of discussion of the so-called Tabor, the sort of a formula for how
the
much money ought
rights.
To grow based on your growth and whatnot. And so they were much more focused on sort of the overall number. And it was just a very different approach to things.
There did seem to be this sort of sense of cementing gains, like the Taxpayer Bill of Rights would have sort of cemented tax cuts for years and years and years, as did like the local government proposals, like changing the Greensboro City Council, the Wake County Board of Commissioners. It seemed as though, if I can be blunt about it, it seemed as though Republicans in the General Assembly were very focused on sort of keeping control of the seemingly places where they could.
It's interesting. All the things you mentioned are Senate side provisions. They probably wouldn't have been matters that the House would have taken up on its own. And again, it's I think it's a reflection of the the differences in these two bodies. North Carolina is not a home rule state, and while we have a lot of people move here from other places that have sort of a different sense of what the relationship is between state government and localities and counties, that is not what North Carolina law is. Municipalities and counties are established by the state and are the way the state provides state programs and services. Cities have more of an ability to sort of do things that are, you know, unique to their area. And I think Republicans generally, though, have not liked, cities who are out there establishing policies that run broadly counter to what may be going on in the rest of the state. They tend to want some level of uniformity. I was the author of a bill related to livestock and animals. It was a direct reaction to an ordinance that was passed by Buncombe County that sort of got into the standard of care of how you take care of animals. Well, I mean, shouldn't we have one standard of care across the state as opposed to having cities and counties establish that standard of care? And I think most Republican leaders generally feel like, yeah, we need sort of one rule on a range of different things across the state. And no, we're not going to allow cities and counties to move strongly in directions other than whatever the statewide standards are.
Just sort of keeping it real here, I mean, I don't. Do you think that would be the philosophy were the state being controlled by Democrats? Do you think that they would say if they passed an ordinance in wherever location that they were from, would that still be the case where they were arguing for uniformity or for a position that may skew?
I think Democrats would be less likely to try to manage, some would say micromanage, what's going on at in the cities and counties. With that said, though, I mean, a perfect example, again, is Asheville Water. When the original Asheville Water legislation was passed in 2003 and 2004, it was three Democrats that put that forward.
Right.
So I don't think you can say, you know, there's a black and white here. I do think probably Democrats would be more deferential to counties and municipalities than Republicans have been.
Would the thinking be the same for, like, say, the Asheville Water if it had been Henderson County that was running the water system and then the legislature came and said Henderson County can no longer run the water system? We're also not going to compensate Henderson County.
We don't have – Hendersonville runs the primary water system in Henderson County. Had Hendersonville had the same history as the city of Asheville had, perhaps you would have gotten the same solution. But unlike there, Henderson County and Hendersonville – have an agreement as between them, as with the other municipalities there, and they work cooperatively together in terms of where they're placing water lines. Water lines, you know, really play a huge role in where you're going to have development. And yet if the city is expanding water lines in places the county doesn't want development, you got a problem.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Hendersonville, I know, was concerned that they may get swept into this whole regional water authority, but, you know, it wasn't the issue there.
Is Asheville being punished for by this bill?
I don't view it as punishment. I think, again, I'm not. City of Asheville looks at the water system as its own. There's where the fundamental problem is. The water system was paid for by the ratepayers, many of which are not in the city of Asheville. There are court cases that have already determined that the city of Asheville, in its not so recent past, but in the past, has used its water system to fund its government, and that's wrong. Again, I think I really like the solution we've got. If you didn't have cities and counties, and you were going to put together a system, you would really look at this thing on a water in, water out basis. That's the environmental leader in me, mm-hmm. talking. And you take wherever you're taking the water out, you're going to put the water in. And really, this regional water and sewer authority will largely do that. Now, there are pieces of it that, you know, at some point in the future, could more of Henderson County be brought into it? Yes, it's part of the French Broad River Basin. It might be there. Because of the topography, though, Henderson County is sort of split. It's the Continental Divide. And so water in part of the county runs to the Atlantic Ocean, and part of the water goes to the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're sitting on a sort of a natural divide as between water systems here.
If the state Supreme Court does take it up, do you expect to prevail?
Yes.
So you have been a longtime environmental advocate, switching gears a little bit. What do you think, as far as what came out of the legislature during this 8-month session, as far as the environment goes?
It's a mixed picture. I think on the budgetary side, I'm really rather happy. We managed to put more money into the Clean Water Management Trust Fund. We put more money into the Parks and Recreation Trust Fund, which funds not just state parks, but counties and cities can apply for park monies. And so I think those were a really positive thing. We put more money into water infrastructure. We got a lot of failing sewer systems around the state, and so cities and authorities that are set up will have a way of funding water infrastructure, which affects water quality around the state. So on the budgetary side, I think we've done pretty good. We moved the parks from Diener over to a new Department of Natural and Cultural Resources, and I think they'll probably get more attention over there, which I think is probably a good thing, particularly with the big state parks we have out west. I am not in the mainstream of with all of my Republican colleagues, though, in terms of the policy side. The two bills that I voted against were the State Environmental Policy Act, SEPA legislation, and at the very end, the Regulatory Reform Act. I voted against that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're better, particularly the latter one is a much better bill coming out of the conference committee than it was as the Senate sent it over. But it didn't get good enough for me as longtime environmental leader.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get comfortable with it enough that I was willing to vote for it.
And when we talked about SEPA earlier in the session, you had mentioned that a lot of these projects that would come under review were actually solar projects.
Yes.
So essentially, did that ease the production of solar power?
I don't know that we know yet. what its impact is. I view the SEPA legislation, while it was framed in terms of reforming the State Environmental Policy Act, I actually view it as effectively a repeal. And you know, I actually told people, if they're going to go as far as they did in limiting the application of SEPA, and that's an act that requires a state to do an environmental assessment of things that it's funding. Mm-hmm. If they're going to go this far, they should have probably just repeal it, because it really doesn't do much of anything.
I see, yeah. Also allowed to expire were the renewable energy tax credits, which I know you opposed the letting them expire.
That's right. That was part of our budget and tax reform effort. They were in the House side negotiating package until the next to last day. We made as much of an effort to extend the renewable energy tax credits as we could. In the end, we couldn't get agreement on that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the effect of that will be on renewable energy projects in the state?
I don't know. I was at the conference, the renewable energy, sustainable energy conference just yesterday and the day before yesterday, talking to, you know, business leaders in the solar industry. There is a slight extension, as long as the project is 80% complete by the end of the year, the tax credit will extend. So there's a little bit of a ramp down that we were able to include.
Mm-hmm.
But I think everybody's trying to figure out if losing these credits will change the leadership role that the state has in the solar area, where, you know, three or four in the nation. I think the federal tax credits actually are more important. And so if you saw Congress roll those back, I think the solar industry, not just here but across the United States, would be really severely impacted.
Do you, and I know the argument for rolling them back is that the solar industry has matured to the point where it could stand on its own two legs. Do you think that's true?
I hope it's true, but I don't know it's true.
I see.
And I would have preferred to. I mean, the solar tax credits, the renewable energy tax credits, have been wildly successful. I mean, they were put in place to bump start the solar industry in North Carolina. They worked. I mean, we were off the charts in terms of the development of solar. The price for solar is coming down substantially, because, you know, it's being brought to scale. And so for me, it was just, you know, I think it's a mistake that what we did. But again, it takes two to reach an agreement.
Yeah.
And this was one of those matters where the Senate and the House were in very different places. On the other hand, we didn't roll back the renewable energy portfolio standards,
mm-hmm.
Which require the Duke Energies of the world to use a certain portion of renewables as part of their energy mix. And so, you know, it's a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting that wasn't rolled back and yet the tax credits were. So does that mean that the loser in this whole thing is Duke Energy?
No, I think Duke is on all sides of this debate. I mean, and I've said this to the Duke folks. I mean, on the one hand, they sort of privately will complain that, you know, we're through the tax credits, particularly we're, you know, subsidizing solar at the expense of other types of energy. But on the other hand, they're spending a lot of money mm-hmm. bringing solar into the mix. So I don't, you know, Duke is pretty upfront that they see renewable energy as part of the mix. It probably, you know, isn't the, you know, we're not going to go totally to renewable energy in the near term. But I don't think in any way they're a loser in this.
It's interesting. NC Warren, the group in Durham, had just come out yesterday, I think, with a press conference, basically asking Attorney General Roy Cooper to basically take Duke Energy to court over some of the things that they did. And the response from a Duke Energy spokesperson was that Duke Energy has done more for renewable energy than NC Warren does in their entire existence, or something along the lines of those. What do you think about that?
Well, again, I think I think Duke is sort of sometimes trying to have it both ways, and which isn't surprising. On the one hand, I mean, they've got a responsibility to their rate base to try to go to the lowest cost, whatever that is. And probably, solar wasn't, although because of the tax credits, I think we're getting to that place. The cost of solar and renewables are coming down, and it's because we were willing to, invest some money into them and bring them to scale. What I'd like to see Duke be about is I introduced a bill 2 years ago, and co-sponsored it this time with my colleague Representative Zoka, to allow for competition, third-party sales. I think if we would allow companies to produce energy and be able to sell it, and not be forced to only sell it to the power company, that competition, I think, would be useful. And, Southern Company, for example, in Georgia, actually supported third-party sales in the legislature down there. Duke Energy has just said no.
Uh-huh.
Like, no.
Why did Southern Company support it?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what their rationale was, but they did support it. And I think we're going, I think more and more people are willing to, whether it's individual solar on their house or solar or wind or something as part of their business, I'd like to see more competition there. Mm-hmm. And I think Republicans ought to be about more competition and force put us in a different position with third-party sales.
Do you think that that's something that's achievable in the near term with the current makeup of the legislature?
Yes. We got very close this year. I mean, within a handful of votes of having enough votes to pass a bill in the House. Mm. And, I've got John Zoka, he's from Cumberland County, is former military officer, one of the most conservative members in the House. Is a lead sponsor of this, and I'm going to work with him if I'm back to try to move third party sales forward.
What did you think of the recent settlement announcement, the $7 million settlement between the new DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, and Duke Energy?
I don't know all the details. I was struck originally by the initial fine, which was $100 million, which struck mm-hmm. me as high.
Well, that was the federal. The
well,
federal,
I know.
So, yeah,
well,
yeah.
No. Well, it was. It wasn't just the. Again,
I think on the state level, it was a $25 million fine for the Sutton plant.
It was 25 for one plant, and right. How do you end up at 7 for a much larger group of plants? Mm-hmm. I don't. I'm a critic of the Department of Environmental Quality, as it's now known. Uh-huh. I think the department has been more about energy production and less about environmental protection than I would like, and I anticipate I'll continue to be a critic.
Do you think that does your criticism extend to the current head of Vandervaart?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Because I know that he's fairly new in there, I guess. Several months, I guess. I'm not really sure.
He was appointed at the beginning of the year.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
As the secretary, he's mm-hmm. very interested in energy policy, and I understand that. I've got a discomfort with thinking that you can be about the department that promotes energy development in the state while you're also the department that is responsible for clean air and clean water. There seems to be a conflict there. The department pushed pretty strongly right at the end to get their name changed to energy and environmental quality. And uh-huh. I viewed that as, maybe that's what they think they ought to be, but that's not what I view that department as needing to be about.
Yeah. Well, so some of the other major things that passed, as you had mentioned before, Medicaid reform. What did you think of that? Were you happy with what came out?
Yes, I was. I think that everybody recognized that we needed to move from a fee-for-service model to payments based on results. And Medicaid is such a large piece of health services that by whatever we do in the Medicaid area is going to affect how health services are provided for everybody. People with insurance and everybody is going to be affected because it's such a large piece. I think we struck a good balance. We allowed provider networks to be in place so that the missions of the world can partner with others and create a network here. But we're also going to allow big national healthcare entities to also compete in the state. So there'll be more choices across the state. Hopefully we'll have, everybody will at least have a choice. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, I represent Henderson County. We're really unique in that we've still got two community hospitals, plus Mission north of us, plus Greenville south of us. Mm-hmm. We're at the epicenter of healthcare. A lot of, unlike Mission, who has a lot of Medicaid patients, in Henderson County, the number is much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
We're mostly private pay, which is, hospitals and doctors are really competing over in some way. So I'm really very happy where we ended up.
Something that hasn't been on the table, obviously, but Medicaid expansion. Do you think this reform puts us on a path towards potentially expanding Medicaid in North Carolina?
I don't think we were going to have Medicaid expansion until we had Medicaid reform. Now, whether the administration will come forward and say, okay, we need to take it the next step, there are, Republican governors in other states that have gone there. The Medicaid reform piece is going to take, 5-6 years to be fully implemented. So I would be a little bit surprised to see the administration come forward with a Medicaid expansion proposal real, real quickly here.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly would be a prerequisite to any proposal to expand Medicaid.
Just looking in the paper and seeing some of the comments Tom Apodaca made about McCrory's role in the budget, he basically said that McCrory had no role in the budget. And McCrory has been at odds with different sets of leadership over the years. Were McCrory to bring about a Medicaid expansion proposal, does he have enough respect of the legislature? Would they go along with it? I mean, I know that's kind of a blunt question, but does he have that?
I can't. I really don't know. I guess it'll depend on what the facts are.
Mm-hmm.
The governor's, has had a hard time getting his legislative proposals through the Senate and has had more success in the House. Both the Speaker, though, and the President Pro Tem of the Senate, Senator Berger, have said that right now Medicaid expansion is not on the table. And so, if the governor is going to put forward that proposal, he's going to have to marshal some set of facts. It's clear to me, though, that Medicaid expansion doesn't occur unless the administration, whoever that administration is, really comes forward and makes a strong pitch for it, because there's not, in the current majorities in the House and the Senate, there's not a lot of sentiment for expanding Medicaid.
From your vantage point, is there antipathy between Senate leadership and Governor McCrory?
All I'd note is that you know, the governor has had more success in moving proposals forward in the House than he has the Senate. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Antipathy is a little strong, mm-hmm. But actions speak for how what his relationship is with the various bodies and their leaders based on what he's been able to move through the two chambers.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that came last minute dealt with social issues. There was the bill that would ban the sale of fetal tissue. And also Planned Parenthood was effectively defunded, I think, in the budget negotiations. What do you think of those proposals?
Well, the Planned Parenthood provision, I guess, was more a reaction of what was going on nationally. And there have been those proposals made at points in the past, and so it didn't surprise me that it came forward. Again, it was part of a much larger thing. So, I wasn't on the cutting edge of either of those issues as they move forward. Mm-hmm. It was much more a reflection of what was going on nationally and a feeling that we didn't want to be part of that debate.
Mm-hmm.
It was, similar. We had the issue of the magistrates issue early in the session. We caught a lot of flack for it. In retrospect, after what went on in Kentucky, I was pretty darn glad that we ended up handling it the way that we did. We've had some magistrates across the state that have opted out, but, it's just not the type of issue that you've seen explode in Kentucky because mm-hmm. we managed to sort of, diffuse it by the way we chose to take it up.
Of course, if you're saying it's diffused for the couples who go to get a marriage license, it probably wouldn't be diffused for them.
But as a public issue, it is, and they're going to get their marriage license. Mm-hmm. It may take a little bit longer, but there is going to be a clerk of the Superior Court or a magistrate that will be available in every place across the state.
Mm-hmm. I know the gay community was very concerned at the end of the session regarding Skip Stam, the proposal that he brought forward to the House, which I know that, at least in terms of process, you rebuked him publicly on the House floor, at least as far as saying, I would like this bill to go back to committee.
That's right. I hate it when we do this, but luckily the House has a Rule 44. I was the first one to use it, actually, on a bill related to solid waste about 2 years ago, where you get a conference committee, one of these committees as between the House and the Senate, to try to compromise on whatever's in the bill, and then they suddenly throw something totally new into the bill. And Representative Jackson from Wake County objected to this new material being put in a bill, and after he made his motion to send this back into committee, which in this case actually effectively killed it, I was the first to speak in support of Democratic Representative Jackson's opinion here. Mm-hmm. I just think we had no reason to take up this sort of issue in whole cloth suddenly on the floor of the House on just an up and down vote. I mean, we didn't even have a chance to amend it. So it went back to committee and got killed.
Were lawmakers hearing from a lot of constituents at that point?
No, because no one knew it was happening. I mean, it came out of a conference committee, suddenly is on the floor, and you're going, now, where did this come from? No one back here and back in my district knew what was happening, and that's why we shouldn't be doing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very happy to Skip Stam is a friend. He's a range of social issues. He's very bought into. I understand what he was about, but I just disagreed with the approach he had to take. If he wants to raise that bill and have a full debate in the House and the Senate, I'm willing to debate it, but I don't like issues brought up that way.
Skip Stam announced his retirement right before the end of the session. He'll be in the short session. There have been rumors, actually, about Tom Apodaca and about you as far as the future of being in the legislature. Are you going to run again?
I haven't decided. I'm less than a week post session. It was a very tough session. So you'd ask me the day after, I would have probably said yes, just because I was so tired. I mean, I don't function real well at 4 a.m. Senator Apodaca has been in the Senate since 2002. If he decides he wants to retire, certainly it's understandable. In the mountain area, we haven't, had in recent years. I think a lot of mountain folks feel like anything west of 77, Raleigh doesn't understand we're here. And so we've got a pretty strong delegation from the West at this point. And, I think we'll talk about these things. And the difference this year is the primary begins with qualifying on December 1st. So we're less than 60 days out from the start of the election cycle. Mm-hmm. And it'll be over early, and we're coming back into session earlier next year.
Mm-hmm. So you'll have to have made a decision by that time, basically.
Yeah, I mean, the qualifying period, I think, runs from December 1st to 21st. I expect there may be 10 or 12 retirements in the House.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard from senators that I might be surprised at the number of senators who are retiring. Again, a lot of people in my caucus, Republicans in the House and the Senate, came in 6 years ago, and it's or 5 years ago, 6 years at the end of the term, and are beginning to say, well, I've done my public service, and it's now time that I get back. And when you're in session as long as we are, it's really hard to, particularly if you live the distance that Senator Apodaca and I do from Raleigh, it's just hard to run a business, have family life, and whatnot if you're going to be in session as long as we were this year.
How do you manage that on a personal level? Do you come back on weekends? I mean, what's the lifestyle like?
I go over on Sunday night, miss the traffic there Sunday night, work in the office Monday morning, Monday afternoon, and evening. We typically have a session, and then we have sessions Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Thursday, they try to schedule them a little earlier in the day. So ideally, I get out of Raleigh Thursday afternoon or early evening, and then I'm back here late evening. I'm back in my district and doing legislative sorts of things, meeting with constituents and whatnot on Friday and Saturday, and then on Sunday I'm back. And so that's my normal week.
That's a grind.
It is. And then during the budget session, I lost two or three weekends where I stayed there all week. Senator Apodaca, I think, spends more time in Raleigh. He's, the rules chair. And it's really tough for legislators that are living a long distance away. I mean, Representative West is way west. And he's got a five-hour trip. Mm-hmm. And if you're coming from the coast, you've got the same sort of thing. So you I lose a day a week, 8 hours driving, even before I get to any legislative meeting or any votes or anything else.
Mm-hmm. I read an editorial recently. I forget who wrote it, it was just in the past few days. It was saying that we're one of the largest states that has a part-time legislature, and that the argument was that we in the state treat the state as if it's smaller than it is. Do you think that there should be a full-time legislature in North Carolina?
I feel strongly both ways on that thing. On the one hand, I much prefer the idea of a part-time legislature and citizen legislators, people that are, this is not their full-time job. But on the other hand, the amount of time it takes and I make $13,000. Yeah, I get compensated for room and board and travel. And so, the the total package probably is 40-some-odd thousand dollars when it's all thrown in. But
in committees, I assume, right?
Well, and when committees meet in the off season, yeah, I get I get the same travel compensation, mm-hmm. but the salary is 13. That means most people can't serve in the General Assembly. Functionally, you just can't. I mean, and you've got the geographic issues that Western or Eastern legislators have, which, you know, there's nothing you can do about that. But, you know, it would be probably better if we had more people that had kids and normal lives and could, you know, represent probably a broader diversity of views. We end up getting more retirees. We end up getting more independent business people who, you know, can let go of their business and have the financial wherewithal to be able to serve. And so it does narrow the pool a bit of who could serve in the General Assembly. Mm-hmm. I was back in the 90s, early 2000s, people speculated that I'd run for the General Assembly, and I kept telling them, I've got two kids in school and I'm running a business. No. I mean,
So what changed?
My kids grew up yeah. and I sold my business.
I see. Yeah.
And I ran a summer camp for kids. Well, a summer camp and the General Assembly are totally inconsistent. Huh. If I were running a summer camp now, I would have not had almost any days at the summer camp the entire time because we were in session the entire time.
Yeah.
So it is what it is. It restricts who can, as a practical matter, serve in the General Assembly.
Well, looking back, what are you most proud of from this session? What are some of the biggest disappointments, I guess?
Well, I'm glad we got an autism bill. That was something I had worked on now for 4 years. The Senate in the last session was unwilling to take it up because it was an insurance mandate. We sort of got past that, but then got hung up on a lot of the details. And in the waning days, it was Senator Apodaca and I managed to reach a compromise and pass a bill. And I think that was something I'm really excited about doing. Being in the position to begin to put money back into things like the Clean Water Management Trust Fund, like the Parks and Recreation Trust Fund. I mean, I served on the Clean Water Management Trust Fund board way back when. I've spent 30 years as an environmental advocate. Being able to begin to fund things that I think really need to be funded that will result in more recreation areas and cleaner air or water has been among the most gratifying parts. And it's sort of, you know, I pinch myself periodically going, you know, I've only been there 5 years and I'm chairing a committee that where I can make a difference. Mm-hmm. So
that's got to be a good feeling.
That's been fun. The disappointments are, you know, my colleagues, it's funny, like on the coal ash issue, my Republican colleagues often don't follow my lead, but I'm rather amused on occasion when something goes wrong, who they want to put out front. So, you know, that's sort of a mixed bag for me. We passed a local regulatory reform bill that had some really bad stuff in it, including things that affected bike paths. And that all, I served on the conference committee on that. We stripped all that out and rewrote the riparian buffer provisions in that bill, and I actually supported it. Mm-hmm. So I like a regulatory reform bill that has environmental provisions that make sense to me, because mm-hmm. I think regulations, environmental regulations that make economic sense is a win-win. On the other hand, I'm very disappointed with the larger regulatory reform bill. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I was on the conference committee on that. We made some real significant improvements. But with that said, I think it provides less protection for isolated wetlands. I'm very concerned about the self-audit and limited liability provisions and the risk assessment provisions in the bill. Mm-hmm. You know, it's detail that most constituents, you know, they get glossy-eyed as you try to delve into it. But I don't think we struck the right balance with that legislation.
And we were talking about your future. Does that weigh on you as far as being one of the most forceful advocates of the environment and in the party in power and someone who's gaining seniority and stuff? Does that weigh on you as a sense of obligation?
It weighs on me. I don't know a sense of obligation. I oftentimes feel like I catch it from all sides. Most of my life has been spent as an environmental advocate. You know, I now have to take positions that probably wouldn't have been my positions when I was in that role. But my role now, oftentimes, is to, you know, get the best I can or incrementally move forward as opposed to go where I really would like it to go. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, I was, you know, National Sierra Club president. I think I'm probably the only Republican that ever, at least in recent history, served in that capacity. And so there I was sort of viewed as, you know, this very conservative environmental leader. And now I'm in the House, and at least within my caucus, because of my positions on the environmental stuff and my wildly independent ways, I'm oftentimes viewed as, you know, he's on the sort of liberal end of the party. And, you know, I get
so you're
wildly
used to being
Democratic support on occasion.
Yeah, so you're used to being
so I'm
an
catching
outsider.
I'm sort of catching it on, you know, the opposite side this time. But
yeah.
Again,
can't win.
You know, the Speaker Tillis, when he was there on coal ash, immediately went to me. And we passed the first in the nation Coal Ash Management Act that at the time some organizations, environmental organizations, were critical of, and now not so much. Mm-hmm. You know, we turned out to be in a stronger position than, what the feds decided to do. That's sort of my life. I think the environmental community was very happy with the work that I did on those two conference committees. Mm. To the point that they had almost no criticism of House Bill 44. And while their criticism of House Bill 765 is certainly still there, they'd be very quick to say that, you know, some of the worst stuff got taken out. And, you know, how did that happen? That was Representative McGrady. It's gratifying in that regard. I keep working on DuPont State Recreation Forest stuff, and we got some more money, and hopefully, I'd love to see an announcement sometime soon that we've really, you know, consolidated all of that property.
Well, great. Well, sort of much like this session, this conversation has gone on for a long time. Is there anything else that you want to say about this session, or anything that we didn't cover?
No, you hit all the high and low points. So.
Well, I appreciate your time, and thanks for making the drive and everything.
No problem. Glad to be here.